Microphones off. We back live from Vietnam Friday. How's everybody doing out there? We live on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Decided to go a little early because I was had to accommodate a guest that's supposed to be coming on here soon. And hopefully he'll be coming on here real shortly and whatnot. And if not, you know, me, I'll just go with some topics that I think we should discuss. Give me 1 second here. Making sure I post all these accounts and whatnot. Make sure y'all comment, like, subscribe, all that good stuff. Appreciate everybody that's tuning in right now. Let me give our guests a little bit of time to come on. And let me text to make sure we're still good. So tomorrow I'll be doing music reviews. I don't know what time I'm gonna be doing music reviews yet. Have no clue. Gotta change this background real quick. I'm a little off my game today. That's what happens when you take a week or almost a week off or a day off. You got to keep doing it. Got to stay in tune. Consistency and persistency is really the key. So we're doing music reviews tomorrow. Make sure y'all submit liveforvietnam@gmail.com. Let's go ahead and promote some QR codes and some other businesses real quick. We got the Paul Pickett podcast, of course, hosted by me, the one and only Paul Pickett, also known as Paul Masson. And you can scan that QR code. That'll take you to the Paul Pickett podcast. We got interviews, and I started ramping up the React videos. I just put out a few React videos this week, and we got some brand new interviews and more interviews on the way. Also, Dizzle brand, I got the hoodie on right now. Dizzle is a premium luxury liqueur mixed with agave tequila, cognac, and orange liquor mango mix. So your Dizzle on ice, and it's nice. Scan that QR code. You can go get your very own bottle or bottles of Dizzle brand premium luxury liqueur. Also, we got new litter apparel exclusively available at millions.co for all you dog lovers. We got the Pitbull t-shirts, Dobermans, and other dog various t-shirts as well for all you dog lovers. And the cat lover t-shirts are coming real soon as well for all you cat lovers that say that cats got litters too. Wherever you are. All right, so let's see if he's about ready to come on, and we'll give him a chance to come on. It's crazy, man. You got the Remy Martin and Papoose situation going on. I don't know how that's going to end. Apparently, Papoose is trying to file for divorce, and Remy won't divorce him. And he said she cheated on him. She's saying he cheated on her with Clarissa Shields. Clarissa Shields is calling her out for a fight, which I don't think Remy Martin wants to. I don't think she wants any parts of Clarissa Shields in a ring at all. I think you might want to let that go. It's kind of crazy. I mean, Papoose held her down while she was in prison. Like, he stayed with her while she was in prison and all that. And, you know, like, most of the time when dudes go to prison, women definitely don't stay with them. Women will cheat. Women will leave them, all types of stuff when dudes go to prison. So, it's like, I think it's very rare to see, like, a situation where a woman's going to prison and the dude is still with her and standing by her side. So, yeah, man, I think, like, if Remy did cheat on him, she's kind of wrong for that. I mean, like I said, the dude stayed with you while he's in prison. All right, we about to bring on our guest. Some of y'all might know them as the RBL Posse, also known as Ruthless By Law Posse. And this is actually the only remaining member of the group. We're going to bring him on right now, the one and only Black C. Oh, we just lost him. Hold up. Hopefully he'll come back. connection just went out, I guess. Hopefully he'll come right back. So yeah, the Remy and Papoose situation is an ugly one. It's an ugly one. It just goes to show you there's not too much loyalty. All right, here he goes. Let's bring him on. Black C, how you doing, man?
What's up with you?
Chilling. How's the weather out there?
Ugly, man. It's ugly right now. You know,
got that good weather.
Yeah. I ain't gonna lie. We kind of need it, though. We need this rain.
All right, so how much time you got?
I probably got about 40 minutes or so. You know,
okay. I ain't gonna run it too long.
Yeah, at the same time I can, you know, my earpiece wasn't working. I was gonna say I can kind of get out because I'm helping my boy right now with some other stuff. And he got me out here, man. I almost forgot about our little interview thing. I got out and got to meet him at Best Buy and was like, oh man, I got away from my computer. But we can work it from the phone. This'll work.
Okay, so I'm gonna start here. So you grew up in Hunters Point in San Francisco. Was that a tough neighborhood to grow up in?
Yeah, it's a tough neighborhood, but I mean, to me at the time, it didn't feel like it, you know, because when you're growing up in that environment, you're used to it. You get used to, you know, as far as drug addicts being around, you know, as far as like just hustlers to whether it's just, you know, we didn't have gangbangers, but we had people who was out there who represented the neighborhood, who was doing anything. You know, as far as, you know, being protective of certain individuals or who they hang with and all that, you know, it's more like a turf thing out there. So, you know, it was a lot of stuff going on, shootings and killings and all that. But really early on when I was young, it wasn't really like that. It was mm-hmm. more like a village. You had fun. It was stuff around from the pimping, you know, players and hustlers all out there. But it didn't really start until I say crack hit. Then that's when it kind of got crazy in my community. But besides that, nah, it was fun. You know, we had the boys club up there. We had the Hunters Point gym. You know, it was a lot of activities going on. It was a lot of kids outside. We was outside every day. You know, basketball court in the middle of our neighborhood. We used to keep it popping over there. I mean, it was dice games and everything. It was cool. You know, it was love. I was around all that. And it didn't seem like nothing. It didn't feel like I was in a bad environment. It didn't feel like I was in the hood or the ghetto or whatever. You know, it was fun.
So y'all came out in the early 90s. What was the process of getting exposure in the early 90s?
You just had to get out there. To be honest with you, it made it easier by having a good song. You just travel. Word of mouth was the thing. You know what I mean? We put out a couple songs in the neighborhood, or I could say not even a couple songs. It was like a couple compilations or something. This was before compilations was even popular. There was a bunch of guys from my neighborhood who I produced for, T-Lo, Dre Hype, who was my brother, who became a hype man later on, Budweiser, Herb Young. It was so many guys in my neighborhood I used to make songs for, and then we packaged all that up. And was selling the cassettes for like $5 before CDs. We were selling the cassettes for $5 a piece, and people was coming by buying it, you know, because we was representing the neighborhood. And that it was just word of mouth. People hear about it, they come up there looking for it. Man, y'all got them cassettes? I just heard this song y'all was playing. HP Is My Home, or this and that. And from there, I was just doing beats at the time. And when I started kind of producing for myself, I made a song myself when guys start kind of like, you know, they start playing games on coming to the studio. So I start rapping on my own beats, and I made a song called What About My Niggas, and I kind of named everybody in my neighborhood. And I took the too short approach where you just kind of name dudes from your neighborhood, they're gonna play the song. And that's kind of what happened. I did that, and it took off. Everybody came up there looking for it. So I did the same thing over again. I did Rolling Through the Turfs of HP. This time I, you know, then visualized myself driving through every neighborhood in Hunters Point, which is my section in San Francisco. And I just started naming all the popular dudes, putting their names in the songs. And that took off. And from there, it was all I was. It was off to the races for me. I became a rapper, and you know, it was on. So we, it was good. It worked for me because I like I said, we dropped the first album. You know, because that first album was really like my solo album. Mm-hmm. It was like a people noticed, like sort of like a psycho. A lot of them songs are solo songs. I added Mr. Cion. He come in and do a verse at the end of sort of like a psycho, a lesson to be learned. He come in and do a verse at the end. More like an orgy. That's all my solo. You know, Bammer Weed was actually a song I did with two other dudes called as dude T Lee and T Rob. It was called Don't Give Me No Bammer Joint. We don't smoke that shit on this point. That came out first before we switched it to Bammer Weed. So a lot of them songs I brought over into the RBL chapter, which was going to be my solo album, but I kind of got cold feet and was just like, you know, I'm really a producer. I need to get a rapper to actually be the lead man. So I tried to bring T-Lo in, and T-Lo was like the Ice Cube of our neighborhood.
Okay.
And Herm Lewis put him out on Black Power later on, Black Power Productions, but he didn't want to do it because he had a lot of dudes getting at him wanting to put him out. So he the one linked me with Mr. C. He was like, you know, I can't do it, but I got Mr. C. It was his girlfriend's brother. So he was like, you know, I bring him up here. You know, all he do is rap. And he was big into like the East Coast rappers, Kool G Rap, you know, the rappity rappers, Big Daddy Kane, Rakim, like Mr. C was into them. You know what I mean? And it showed in his lyrics when he got up there. We made a song called Hit Squad New Jack. It was called the Hit Squad at first. And then Eric Sermon and all them, they, Paris and them, they took that. And once they put their stamp on the Hit Squad, we changed our name to RBL. T-Lo ended up giving us the name Ruthless by Law, which we shortened it when we went in the studio because the Ruthless by Law just seemed too long. But yeah, that's pretty much how I jumped in. And then it just seemed like it was easy because it was the word of mouth. We didn't do too much promo. We didn't press up flyers and flats and do the Snipe campaign later on. That came almost like 5-6 months later after the release once we signed to Intermittent Records. But back then, it was just really word of mouth. You know, if your music was good, it's one of those things where it's like each one teach one. You know, good dudes is playing your music. They got beat in the car. They own 3rd Street somewhere. 3rd Street was like our Crenshaw. It was equivalent to Crenshaw in L.A. where everybody kind of ride up and down the street in their cars. It was one of the main streets, you know. It was one of those things where if you bumping it, people ask, who was that? Oh, man, that's RBL. That's such and such name from Hunters Point. That's Black Seed, Mr. C. And they go to the record store and buy it. And, you know, it just traveled like that, you know. And it worked out for us.
Now, what is Ruthless by Law? What exactly does that mean?
We didn't have no meaning. It was just, it just sounded good, to be honest with you. And I mean, I guess it just mean exactly what it says, you know, we ruthless by law, you know, we ain't breaking laws to be ruthless. We ruthless on the records and stuff. You know what I mean? So that's what me and Mr. C took it. But it just sounded good. You know what I mean? Because we was kind of into NWA and them, and they was on their ruthless thing. They was on, you know, the ruthless records and all that. So we were just trying to be ruthless like them. Like I said, at first we was the Hit Squad. And once they took that, once he said, man, y'all ruthless by law. And we didn't even realize, it just sounded good. But then once we started, you know, we shortened it to RBO Posse, and people used to ask, what does ruthless by law mean? We just was like, you know, it just mean like, man, we ain't breaking no laws to be ruthless. We ruthless on the microphone, you know, we ruthless on at shows. We, you know, it was just like by law, you know what I mean? So we ain't breaking no laws to be ruthless. So it was one of those things, but... You're actually the first person that ever asked me that in an interview. That's what's crazy.
I interviewed Just Ice recently, and he was labeled a gangster rapper, right? Mm-hmm. Now, he said the labels gave him that label. So, did you consider yourself a gangster rapper or just a rapper?
I consider myself just a rapper, and people started kind of labeling us gangster rapper because I looked at our music as kind of like, it was more like, it was gangster, had a gangster feel to it, but it was more like party because ours was up-tempo and it was a little bit different than like NWA and 415, the dudes we looked up to that came before us, IMP, Ill-Mannered Posse and all them. I kind of felt like they was considered gangster rap or whatever. And it was only because we was kind of, everybody was kind of comparing us. We were similar to NWA. We was like the NWA of the Bay Area. So, and they stuff was considered gangster. So we just kind of got put in that category. But when we was making music, we were just doing it on what we feel. We didn't really look at it as like, oh yeah, we finna make gangster music. I just went in there and just was, we just rapping. Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you end up signing with In a Minute Records?
With that, it was one of those things where I pressed up 1,000 copies. I put them in stores on consignment, you know, because we was big on the independent game out here in the Bay Area, you know, just based on like Too Short and them, with E-40 and them was doing with St. Charles and them. Everybody was out the trunk with it. Everybody we knew. So that's how we kind of got in the game, is selling it yourself. We didn't go looking for labels because there wasn't none really out here. You had to be, we felt like you had to be in L.A. or you had to be in New York as far as to get a deal. So everybody we knew, from the smaller groups to the Huey MCs, Rapping Forte and a lot of other dudes who was out, they all was pressing their stuff they self and selling it out the trunk, a bunch of cassettes. So we did the same thing. I pressed up 1,000. I rolled around going to stores, leaving them on consignment. You know, I'll leave it with them like, hey, give me $7 a cassette and let me know when y'all sell out. I'll come back, collect the money and drop y'all some more. So them 1,000 sold out in like 3-4 days, you know, once the word of mouth went around. Because I think I gave away, because they overpressed, because they could underpress or overpress. You might get maybe 80, 90 over, or they say you might get, you know, 80, 90 less than that 1,000 that you press up. So sometimes it's over, sometimes it's under. And we end up getting a little over 1,100. So I gave away 100 of them, just passing them around to people who had music in their car. If you had beat in your car, I gave you a cassette. And that was free promo for me. They riding around, they got the beat, they slapping it, and that helped send people to the stores. So I left them on consignment at, over there at Creative Music, over in Ocean, at different sections of San Francisco. Only in San Francisco, I did it for about a day or two, and it started selling. Then we ended up going to Oakland, leaving it at a couple stores once we got word that it was a few stores over there, because we didn't know where the stores was in Oakland. So we got word, I think it was TC or somebody that helped us with that. So we went over to like T.Y. Uzi's and a few spots and left them over there. By the end of that week, they was gone. Everybody wanted more. My 1,000 cassettes was gone. So when I went and pressed up, I got the money. I made about a little over $5,000 on those. And I went and invested all that money in and bought another. I bought 5,000 of them. So by the time I did that, In a Minute, Totally Insane was over there doing the deal. So people was calling the distributor, because In a Minute Records is a one-stop. They the music people, but they got a label in the inside, which is In a Minute Records.
Okay.
Elliot Blaine is the one. That's Jason's father. He ran the whole distro, which was the music people who shipped CDs and, I mean, cassettes and stuff out at the time all over the place, to the South, the Midwest. So it was like a one-stop distro. And his record label in the inside of there, which they occupied like a small little space, was called In a Minute Records, and they was doing a deal with Totally Insane. And Elliot and them started asking TC and them like, man, you heard of RBL Posse people calling in asking about it? And he was like, yeah, I helped engineer that whole album, you know, I produced a song on it. And he was like, man, I want, get me in touch with them. People calling. I got a lot of stores calling, wanting to buy, you know, wanting to purchase some of the CDs.
Yeah.
So we end up coming out there. When I got the, I had the 5,000 cassettes, I came out there and he was like, man, how you feel about doing the deal, letting us take over? I will pay you 5,000. I'll pay you $5 COD. I'll cash you out for those COD for the 5,000 that you just pressed up, and I'll give you an extra 10,000 on the top to give us exclusive rights to distribute it. And at the time, we didn't realize we was doing an artist deal. We didn't care. Really, I didn't even care. I was just trying to get that extra money.
Yeah.
I was like, man, he about to give us 25,000 plus another 10 on top. That's 35,000. All I was thinking about was going to go get some more drugs and hitting the block and doing my thing. I was like, man, let's do it. Come on. And he was like, man, go get a lawyer and have him read the contract. I'm like, man, I don't even want to waste no money trying to get a lawyer. You know, I was like, this is easy. I could easily make another album. You know what I mean? He said, well, I want to pretty much lock y'all in for like three albums. I'm like, yeah, that's easy. That's nothing. I could knock that out fast. It's like, yeah, let's do it. And he said, man, I advise you to go get a lawyer. So Jason was, I can't really blame him for us, you know, for us only signing for the 10,000, because we was pissed off once we start knowing, learning about mechanicals and royalties and, you know, the what our percentage was about our points and everything. We was pissed off, but he did tell us to go over the contract and get a lawyer, and we didn't. We chose not to, and we signed a shitty deal pretty much. And you know what I will say is, even though the deal was messed up, he got us the exposure. He did get us out there. You know, we sold close to 300,000 units before we left him on pretty much each album. That was just with SoundScan, so we don't know what we sold as far as, because there was a lot of mom and pops that wasn't at the time. SoundScan wasn't at, okay, in every store. You know what I mean? So you had to check pretty much the shipping reports to see what you really sold. But he used to only show us the SoundScan, and the SoundScan that kicked in way later on. You know, probably months later, we start finding out, once we start going in, asking when do we get paid. And he was just like, yeah, this is how it works. You got to wait 90 days, blah, 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 this and that. And we end up getting a manager and got our team together, got a lawyer. We start going at him. And that's when everything kind of started falling apart with us. And in a minute, that we start realizing that he was pocketing money on us, you know.
Now, your first single, Don't Give Me No Bammer, made it Billboard Magazine Hot Rap Singles chart, peaking at 16. What was the feeling like at that time?
Man, it felt good, because it was one of those things where I knew it was I knew it was going to do numbers, but I was only expecting it to do good in the Bay Area. I didn't even care about, really, San Francisco. I ain't even going to say the Bay Area. I just really wanted Frisco to be playing. That's why I put No Bammer Weed, We Don't Smoke It in the SFC. I was just really wanting Frisco to come together and play it, which they did. And then it was like a virus. It just went to Oakland and Richmond and Vallejo and Sacramento, San Jose, then out of state. A lot of people was going to school in Atlanta. They threw the Omega Boys Club that we had out here as a program where they was just sending kids off to college. And a lot of them was like my peers who went to school with me, went to high school and everything with me. And they start going off to college and they start taking the cassette with them. And they took it everywhere. And then all of a sudden we popping up in Detroit. Detroit was one of our hot markets, and St. Louis, and then Kansas City, you know, it just starts spreading like a virus, you know, Seattle, Portland, Phoenix, Arizona, a lot of them, you know, SoCal, all through Southern California, San Diego, you know, all the Los Angeles area. They, man, it just was like a virus. It took off, and man, it was a blessing.
Now, your third album was your most successful as far as Billboard goes. Why do you feel that was?
Probably because we had Atlantic behind us, the Eye for an Eye. Yeah, I think it was just Atlantic Records. You know, you got that machine behind you. I think we'd had that real, like, if Jason would have really pushed the first two albums, A Lesson to Be Learned and Ruthless by Law, them would have did numbers. But he was a small company, and he didn't want to have to pay. He didn't want to bring in the employees to help. He didn't want to make his staff bigger. You know, that was his downfall. And that's what set everybody back, from us to Dre Dogg, a.k.a. Andre Nicotina, to Totally Insane. Like, he had some artists that he could have really been like a Death Row Records or something up in the Bay Area, you know, but he didn't want to spend the money. But that's what held that album, them albums back. But, you know, when you got a machine like Big Beat Atlantic Records, man, Craig Callaman and them and Mike Caron and them got behind it, it made it do good. I was surprised, because to be honest with you, that's like one of my least favorite albums, but a lot of people love it. That's the only reason why it's my least favorite, because I didn't really produce on that album. I was going through the loss of Mr. C, and I was just in my feelings some type of way. So, and it was just every song, we kind of lost our female fan base on that, because the first two albums, we had a big female fan base. But once we started getting on that rah-rah, Eye for an Eye, Kill Up This and That, and, you know, just being mad, we lost them a little bit. You know, even though I had a few songs that was, I tried to tailor towards the females, but it just didn't work. It wasn't the same. You know, we lost that party, RBO, party vibe, mob funk party type vibe, because it was all Rick Rock majority Rick Rock produced, you know.
Now, was that the same album you were working on when Mr. C passed?
Before Mr. C passed, we didn't even really have none. We was doing compilations at the time. We was like the compilation killers. We was doing a bunch of compilation songs. And what happened was we was working on Hitman. Hitman okay. album was what we was pushing at the Hitman and NOH Mafia. Hitman came out, blew up. You know, I pressed his up, was out the trunk with it. He sold over 220,000 copies, and I was selling them out the trunk. COD, getting the money from City Hall Records. I was going over there. So we wasn't working on nothing except NOH Mafia. We was trying to set up our groups that we was producing and putting out. And, when Mr. C passed, we didn't have no music sitting around. That's why I didn't really have no verses to use on the Eye for an Eye album, because we only worked when we needed to work. Well, we weren't just in there just like, let's just making songs just all day, every day. Nah, we kind of went in and worked when it was time to work on the album. Plus, I was the producer. I was working with, like I say, NOH Mafia. I was producing songs for other groups that was around Hunters Point, who was wanting me to produce music for them. So we were so tied up that we never really got in and actually just get a head start on a new album, you know. So, yeah, once Atlantic got at us, we didn't really have nothing. We was just ready to go to work because we didn't know what we was going to do. Once they signed us, I was going to produce probably majority of it, but we was going to be over there. We was going to have to go deal with Enhancer. We probably was going to have Selsky on there. And we probably would have stepped out and got a couple other producers. But for the most part, I probably would have produced maybe 70% of it, 60 to 70%. And we just never got around to it.
Now, was Hitman part of the group before Mr. C passed or after he passed?
Nah, after he passed, we just always let people think he was part of the group. He never was officially in the group or signed in the RBL. It's just that when Mr. C passed, Craig Callaman was just like, man, you know, I know you produced everything. Hitman reminds me of Mr. C as far as how he lyrically would come. I know he can't fill his shoes, but how about we still do an RBL album? You know, we can sign, instead of us doing a 5-album deal, let's do 3 albums. And, you know, we can work the numbers down now that Mr. C gone, because now we taking a chance, we taking a risk. He's like, you know, we still want to sign you. We still got you here as a producer. We think Hitman going to do good. His numbers on his solo album did hella good. So how about he just step in and kind of fill that void for you? And I was like, all right, yeah, we could do that. So that's how he kind of became a part of it. Once I went on to do the Eye for an Eye album, I brought him in to kind of do more Mr. C parts. So he was never official. He always was a solo artist. But, you know, when I needed him, he couldn't come in and do his thing. So for the Hostile Takeover, the last 2 albums, which was Hostile Takeover and Eye for an Eye, Ms. Hitman stepped in and did his thing.
Now, what was it like working with MC8?
Man, that was a dream come true, because before I was even in the studio rapping, I was sitting out on the block hustling the MC8. And it was my album. I was playing CMW, Compton's Most Wanted, and I was playing the Mad Circle. I got video footage of me playing the Mad Circle, which was, a lot of people don't know, Coolio and Dub C and them. They was the Mad Circle bumping that, like, then was the 2 albums. I couldn't wait to meet Dub C and couldn't wait to meet MC8, you know, along with NWA too. I couldn't wait to meet them, you know, and I finally got a chance to meet Ren and Ice Cube and Eazy-E, you know. It was a dream come true. So it was a blessing when I got to work and do that song with him, man. I loved it, you know, and it's one of my favorite songs off that album.
Now, you got 9 solos. Is there one that stands out to you?
Probably my 70s Baby, just because I like them soulful, like, albums. That's probably the only album I'm going to do a part 2 to, because a lot of people ask me about that. Like, bro, that 70s Baby. Like, man, you need to come back with that. A lot of my fans love that. That album right there is probably my favorite, just because of just the cover, just because of the theme, the 70s, baby. I'm a 70s baby. I just like the soulful feel of a lot of the songs on there. You know, that was my first debut when I had the debut of Larry June. You know, he, as Young June, he was on it. I just felt it was my first album with me just, you know, lyrically just getting better, me evolving, just showing the evolution of Black Sea. From there on, I started kind of slowly climbing, you know what I mean, lyrically. And, yeah, that's probably the one that stands out the most. And then my latest ones, my last two, is probably one of my favorites, just lyrically. But that one for sure stands out.
I wanted to ask you this. What is it about gangsters in American society that we seem to be so infatuated with?
I don't know. I think it's just that bravado, just being the tough guy, and just it's just the respect, you know, is how they demanded their respect. A lot of people, you want that, you know, you want to be respected. You want, you know, you see how the tough gangster, he got the women, he got the respect from the other so-called might be gangsters, bosses or whoever. It's just we always was infatuated with that, from the mafia pictures, from the black exploitation films with the, you know, where the Superfly and all them, the Mac or whoever. It's just something about the guy who just got the women and the respect from other men. It attracts you, you know, and you want that. It's something about it, man. You know, you want that type of love and respect.
Now, Drake and Kendrick, what's the West Coast? How are they feeling about this whole situation out there?
Man, I know one thing. Everybody's just feeling like Kendrick did his thing. They feeling like Kendrick pulled the West together. Where I feel like it's more like a SoCal thing, you know, Southern California. The Bay is the Bay. We doing our thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, so when they say West Coast, I mean, when they think West Coast, they really just be thinking of L.A., you know, because even like, now the West is back. And it's like, it's really an L.A. thing. Y'all down there doing y'all thing. It's necessarily, we not really included in that West. It's more like Southern California. All they rappers is coming together. So, you know, all them it brought a lot of them together. But we still moving out. We moving the Bear. We don't feel like we a part of that. You know, we still moving as the Bay and still doing our thing. But, yeah, it's just one of those things where Kendrick is, I mean, he that guy. Can't deny that. Kendrick that guy when it comes to, you know, just lyrically, just song making, man. Just, he dope. I was a fan since Section 8.0, that Section 80, man. It's,
yeah.
I've been rocking with him since then, ever since I heard that album. You know, I believe it was more like a mixtape. I think I was on it before they re-released it. They put it out, then they re-released it. It was packaged up a little bit, kind of cleaner, had a different look to it. But as soon as I heard Kendrick, I was on him. I already knew. I was like, yeah, he one of them ones, man. And yeah, he's showing it. You know, I wouldn't even try to rock, you know, I wouldn't even try to go against Kendrick. Drake was smart to just bow out gracefully and leave that man alone, because right now the momentum he got is crazy, you know. And yeah, they loving him out here, man. They loving Kendrick. They loving, you know, the Bay Area, like I said, the Bay, you know, we support and love him, but it's crazy. They going crazy for him down there in Southern California, though. It's different.
I normally don't like to ask anything controversial, right? But I mean, you've been through some stuff. Both of your group members pretty much passed. Hitman was murdered. Mr. C was murdered. But specifically Mr. C, there was like a gang war. How crazy were those times?
Man, those times were super crazy, man, because, you know, it was just it's one of those things where, you know, Mr. C was new to my neighborhood. You know, he was only up there. He came up there in late 91, early 92. And, you know, he died in 96. He wasn't up there for 4 years. Man. And the dudes that killed him was people who I knew, you know, or there was people who, the guy who was really supposed to shot him was a youngster who I pretty much damn near raised, since he was like a youngster who was up under me since he was probably, you know, 7, 8 years old. Grew up, you know, we all had relationships. Everybody on that cover besides Mr. C been around each other over 20 years, you know, so it's one of those things where I felt betrayed by the dudes who I grew up with. Mr. C was new, and they didn't like the way his status elevated. The rap thing will elevate your status, you know, when it comes to, like, I ain't gonna say gang or, but just being part of a block or a neighborhood, if you become popular, it automatically kind of puts you on a pedestal, and you ain't gotta really put in work no more, because now you bringing in money, you got females coming through, your status done went up just on the music, on the entertainment, so your respect in the neighborhood go up, even though he wasn't out there fighting at house parties and, you know, gang banging and fighting against Sunnydale Fillmore. He wasn't around and involved in none of that. You know, I was. And I was really one of them reputables in my neighborhood. Like, I was really respected. Dudes looked up to me. And they wasn't going to say nothing to Mr. C just because of what the love that I had, you know, so, and the respect I had in my neighborhood. So it was one of those things where it was just like, man, you know, it separated the hood. It separated us badly. And it was never the same after they killed Mr. C. Everything changed. So, yeah, it was a ugly time. And it forever changed our neighborhood, the whole community, not even just my projects, the whole Hunters Point. Because I'm from Hunters Point, but in Hunters Point, it's different neighborhoods. It's Harbor Road, you got West Point, you got Oakdale, you got Shoreview, you got going all the way down, I mean, Osceola, you got Garlington, it's a bunch, Kirkwood, you know, it's a bunch of different, like, projects and communities up in there. So, yeah, it was different. It forever changed that whole community, because a lot of people lost their lives after Mr. C got killed. It was over, like, 20-some murders that happened after that. So,
damn.
Yeah, it forever changed the neighborhood, man. And, yeah, it ruined everything. It ruined everything, man. But, you know, I mean, I'm blessed to still be around, still be here, still doing my thing, man. And able to still represent this RBL.
We about to be hitting that 40-minute mark. Do you got any new music coming out?
Yeah, I got some stuff that I'm finna put out coming next year. I'm finna just really do singles. I got a bunch of music sitting right now that I got sitting. Probably got about 8, 9 songs, new songs that nobody never heard. I'm getting them together, but I'm thinking about, I got this album that I'm working on with DJ Idea. I'm doing a producer album with him. I got some stuff that hopefully me and DJ Fresh get back on our album. He got an OG series, a legend series that he working on. Me and him got about 4 or 5 songs that we got sitting around. Hopefully we get back on that. And then I got an album that's called Top Hat Music, where I'm finna do a bunch of features, where I'm trying to get, you know, my dream collabs, like the Payroll Giovanni, G Perico, of course, Larry June, Jay Worthy. You know, I'm finna get back tapped in with the OGs, like the Spice One, Sebo, Yuck Mouth. You know, I'm trying to do another album where I got a bunch of features, because usually I don't really look for features. I don't really care about the features. It'd be a headache sometimes trying to get dudes together and round it up. So now I'm finna just try to get on it and just take my time with it and just drop singles. I'm not finna wait to try to collect everything. As I get the feature, I'm gonna package it up, tighten it up, mix, master, and throw it out, and just, you know, slowly just try to build up some momentum. Then I put everything out as a collective, you know.
That's what's up. Definitely keep me in touch, man. I do music reviews on Saturdays, so I'd love to review something.
For surely, man. I got to get you that one that just dropped some months ago, man. That heavy in it, you know. That's what I'm pushing right now. We got a couple more videos that we dropping from that, just to get us over through the first quarter. And then, I say around that second quarter, we working. We're gonna be dropping a lot of content. We got a lot of merch collabs that we got dropping. That's gonna drop And yeah, everybody go get that book, man. You know, I do a deep dive in my book on everything that we just talked about, from this before RBL, during RBL, and after RBL, me going into my solo career, man. So yeah.
Before we let you go, any shout outs you want to do?
Man, you know, just shout out to all the fans, man, who still supporting, who still coming out. You know, it's hard once you lose two members to keep going. And my fans still come out, man. They still come out to see RBL. They still come out to see Black Sea. And it's very hard to do that. There's groups who still here and can't even come together. And people might not even come see them. But from the way my fan base still show up for me, still show up and support, still buy all the Bluebird and Bammerweed merchandise, man. It's a blessing. And yeah, go get that book. The book is titled Black Sea, A Part of Survival from the Block to the Booth. And it's on Amazon. It's on my website, rblposse.com. You know, all my books come signed, but you can still get it on Amazon if you want to get it fast. And, you know, I ship fast too, but some people just more comfortable using their Prime account. You know what I mean? So, either way, it's all good, you know. But check that book out, and man, be looking for me in your town, man, on tour.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out to do this, and I got your number, so I'm definitely gonna keep in touch, man.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Let's lock in. All
right, man. Enjoy the rest of your day, man.
All right, appreciate it.
All right, peace. Wow. Very powerful story there, man. I ain't gonna lie, I was getting a little sad, man, just hearing that. Like, he literally lost two of his group members. Both were murdered, basically in the neighborhoods that they were from. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think he lost the eye in the process. I didn't really want to get into that, man, but you know, that's crazy, man. Literally a gang war over a member dying of his group. That had to be a very impactful thing. And if y'all like reality rap, if you're into your hip hop being real, Black Sea is probably as real as it gets, man. I mean, that's reality rap to the fullest, man. I mean, I can't think of too many rappers that, you know, have a story like his that really reflects in the music so much. And he proved a point, man, that labels put these labels on rappers, like calling them gangster rappers. Like he said, we were just rappers. We didn't call ourselves gangster rappers. They throw that label on you. And I don't know why they do that. I really don't. I don't get it. And I guess it's a gimmick thing. Said Blue Jones is, appreciate you. Blue Bird is the joint. Definitely a lot of info. I can hear a little bit of feedback because he didn't have no earbuds, but I should still get some good clips out of that and whatnot. Tomorrow I'm doing music reviews. Submit that liveforfaitnam@gmail.com. Before I go, I got like 12 minutes. I want to talk about something that me and Brother Jay from X-Clan talked about in an interview I just released with Brother Jay from X-Clan. Go check that out. Definitely a legend in hip hop. And he was talking about the series, the Drake and the Kendrick situation, where the series, which is like owned by Google, you know, it's like Alexa, hey Alexa, hey Siri. So people would go and be like, hey Siri, play Drake music, and it wouldn't play Drake music, it would play the Kendrick Lamar song. So we were, you know, discussing what would be the reasons behind that, and there's only really two reasons that would happen. Number one would be that the AI is still learning. It's still young. It's still learning. It's still got to compute all this information on the internet and process it accordingly. And the other would be if somebody wrote a code. And if I'm not mistaken, Siri's not Google. I think, my bad, I think I got it wrong. I think Siri is owned by Apple. So somebody could have went in and wrote the code where it basically plays Kendrick music instead of Drake music. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they made a point of like, who's big on Apple? Who owns stocks in Apple? Who just sold some headphones to Apple not too long ago? Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine definitely got pulled in Apple. And it's nothing but somebody going in and changing some code and making it where the song, the every time you say play Drake, it plays Kendrick. And I understand, yeah, Drake is tagged to that song and these battle raps that Kendrick put out. But I don't know how many times Kendrick said Drake's name in the songs. Drake's name's not in the titles. So I don't get why, if I said play Drake's specific song, why would it play Kendrick's song? Or if I say play music from Drake, why would it just go play Kendrick? That almost sounds like the code might have been rigged, man. Because that's the thing. Like, AI is learning. So you would think at some point AI would realize, oh, I'm not playing Drake music. I'm playing Kendrick music. I know I use ChatGPT, and every time I create artwork, at first I would put in like I would put something like create an image with hip hop graphics, and then you do comma, and then you put live from Vietnam. So basically it's going to create a hip hop graphics and add the text live from Vietnam. And sometimes it would misspell it at first. But the more I would do it, and the more I would do it, bam, it would get the spelling down pat to the point now every time I put it in, it spells live from Vietnam correctly. And you know AI isn't going to just spell Vietnam correct. Vietnam's not a word in the dictionary. You know, it's in the Fayetteville dictionary, but it's not in the regular dictionary. So yeah, the Siri thing is crazy that you're telling it to play Drake music and it's playing Kendrick music. And I'm pretty sure Drake knows that. I think that was implemented into the lawsuit, if I'm not mistaken. But Brother Jay brought that up and was talking about that, and I just thought it was very interesting. It almost seems like on the legal side, Drake does have an argument. I mean, it's still kind of some bitch shit to sue somebody because you lost a battle rap. But even Brother Jay said, you know, it's far more than battle rap when somebody calls you a pedophile in a song. That's like definitely defamation words. That could ruin your reputation completely if it's not true. So, and another person whose reputation is pretty much, I'm not saying it's somewhat being ruined, because the court of public opinion sides one way or the other, is the Jay-Z situation. So Jay-Z has the lawsuit, filed with his name. The lawsuit was filed, against Diddy at first, saying Diddy sexually assaulted a 13-year-old like 20 years ago. And then they reamended the lawsuit and added Jay-Z's name. Like, they just happened to forget that Jay-Z was involved, if he was involved. I'm throwing it on the record. I don't believe it one bit. I think it's a money grab. I think it's bullshit. And that people already been saying Jay-Z's next, Jay-Z's next, Jay-Z's next. It almost seems like, you know, just something that they heard, oh, Jay-Z's next, so yeah, let's go ahead and throw him in the lawsuit too. Jay-Z hung out with Diddy, this, that, and third, associated with him. This is like the guilty by association thing right now that's going on. And I don't believe Jay-Z was involved one bit. Now, do I believe Diddy had something to do with it? I don't know, because the lawsuit was originally about him. And I was watching a video where a lawyer was saying, because Jay-Z's response was, okay, this is heinous. If I did this, then why not file criminal charges? And some people could be saying, oh, you know, statute limitations and all that. But from what I saw with a video with a lawyer, apparently they could file criminal charges on this still. Apparently they could file criminal charges. And the fact that they didn't, you know, makes me think it's a money grab. It's like, okay, you file a lawsuit. You say Diddy assaulted you. What did you just so happen to forget that Jay-Z had something to do with it too? If Jay-Z allegedly has something to do with it, that makes no sense. How do you forget something like that? How do you file a lawsuit? Oh, you know what? I forgot. Hey, Jay-Z was there too. I totally crossed my mind. It just went right past me. And I totally forgot that Jay-Z had assaulted me sexually 20 years ago too. Like, who forgets that? who forgets that day? Who? I mean, even if he was sexually assaulted like numerous of times, who forgets that? Like, who forgets who was involved in sexually assaulting somebody? That's crazy. Nobody forgets that. So I don't believe the Jay-Z one bit. As far as the Drake lawsuit, it's interesting to see where that's going to go. It's really interesting to see where that's going to go, because if Drake wins this lawsuit, you're going to have more people taking their chances on getting caught out in a song and deciding, hey, you defamed me. And one thing is about defamation lawsuits is you got to prove that you lost money. And I think Drake can prove that he lost money. I think he can prove that he lost some money, maybe some endorsements, maybe some fans. If he had a big drop off from followers, you can attest it to probably the Drake and Kendrick thing. But I can tell you who ain't unfollowing him. Nobody in Canada. Canada looks at Drake like he's Celine Dion, and as they should, because if you want to go gold in Canada, you just got to sell 50,000 units. So 50,000 units, Drake is selling that 10, 20 times in America. So when he sells, you know, goes platinum or double platinum in America, that's literally like going diamond or double diamond in Canada. I mean, if I'm selling 10 million units based off Canada's metrics, hell yeah, man. I should be a freaking superstar in Canada. You know, like if Drake is Lee Dion in Canada, I should be Masan Dion in Canada. I should be the hottest thing on the planet, according to Canada, if I'm pushing 10 to 20 million units, according to their metrics. And I think as long as he's still got Canada backing him, I mean, that alone should be enough. And we know Canada's backing him, because, I mean, look what they did to Rick Ross. Rick Ross, you know, thought he could just talk shit about Drake and just go do a show in Canada like it was all peaches and cream. And nah, dog. Like, they ain't having that. And same thing with, like, Drake probably can't do a show in California at all right now. He probably do a show in California. There's no telling what's going to happen, man. They liable to shoot him up like Biggie, man. I mean, because Biggie literally got killed because Pac got killed. Like, Biggie had, I would bet my bottom dollar on it, Biggie had nothing to do with Tupac's murder. And, you know, a lot of people got allegedly said Diddy had something to do with it. And I wouldn't be shocked if Diddy did have something to do with it, because he allegedly had somebody's car blown up in Kid Cudi? He had Kid Cudi's car blown up, if I'm not mistaken. Jones, appreciate you tuning in still. Yeah, Masan Dion. Like, hell yeah, if I'm selling 10 to 20 million in fucking Canada, man, I mean, damn. I should be Masan and them. I should be the... What's this? What they say? The best thing since sliced bread. I should be the best thing since sliced bread in Canada, man. If I'm selling 10 to 20 million units based on their metrics. I was thinking, like, artists be trying to break themselves in the American market and trying to blow up the American market. You would make more sense to try to go in Canada and only push 50,000 units. I mean, you heard Black Sea talking about the Hitman album sold 220,000 units out the trunk. Imagine if, like, that's literally, that's double platinum according to Canada's metrics. That's double platinum according to Canada's metrics. But when you're selling out the trunk, I mean, that was straight. You can't really sound scale on that back in the days, I don't think. Nowadays, you could sell it out the trunk and actually, you know, register them with SoundScan, because we got the barcodes and all that. They wasn't scanning barcodes while they were selling out the trunk back then. And I don't even know if they had a barcode on the CD when they were selling them out the trunk back then. But he came from, you know, the Bay Area where everybody was selling them out the trunk. Too Short, E-40, everybody was selling them out the trunk because they had no choice. All the major labels was in Hollywood, LA, and New York, mainly. That was the two main places that had labels, New York and L.A. So, yeah, what we talked about, Remy Martin earlier and Papoose, that situation's getting ugly. And Remy might not want to fuck with Clarissa Shields because she going to get the mama said knock you out on her ass. It ain't going to go well for her. And I think, like, the fact that if she did cheat on Papoose like that, it's kind of fucked up, man, after he stayed with her while she was in prison and still held her down and all that. And, yeah, man, I don't know how the interview is going to sound when I play it back. I could definitely hear feedback in his phone, but he did say the earbud, he was having issues with his earbud, but I should get good clips out of that. Definitely should get good clips out of that. And appreciate you, John Jones, for tuning in, man. Get your shit ready for the new year, man. We got to get that background. Let's get them the headphones and that microphone right. And we're going to have a bunch more interviews coming up for the new year as well. And also, I was going to do an interview with Mr. Lin for Company Flow yesterday. He had issues getting his camera to come on. And we're going to try to do a pre-recorded interview next Thursday, same time. And hopefully he got the camera figured out. And if not, we're going to troubleshoot it. And before I do the interview with the restreamers who I stream with. But I definitely want to try to knock that out as well, the Mr. Lin. And I might be interviewing South Star from Smiles and South Star here soon. And I got a bunch of interview requests out as well that I'm waiting on some other replies. I need to reach back out to Pudgy the Fat Bastard. He said he would do an interview a while back. And so did King Just. And a couple other people I got to reach back out to. Sometimes, you know, timing gets a little crazy, you know, gets conflicted. A lot of cats be on the road or have shows or whatever it may be, you know, different time zones. Sometimes shit just happens. When we were going to interview Smoother Hustle, his car got reared in and we had to reschedule. You know, rescheduling is part of the business. It is what it is. I was actually supposed to do the Black Sea last week, pre-recorded. So we ended up doing it live this week instead because he had a show last week. And I ain't want to get in the way of the show. But we about to wrap it up. I just went over the hour mark. Music reviews tomorrow. Submit them to livefromfayetteville@gmail.com. I repeat, livefromfayetteville@gmail.com, MP3 only. And I don't know exactly what time I'll be doing music reviews. I don't really have a set time. It's just when I feel like just going on and doing music reviews. And I'll do like a good like 30 to 40 minutes of music reviews. Well, we're about to wrap it up. Another episode about to get off here, clip up the clips. Definitely. And you know what's crazy? He said I'm the first person that interviewed him that asked him, what did the RBL mean? I didn't know what it meant until I went and did my research. And he said there was no meaning behind the Ruthless by Law, but they were big on the Ruthless Records, Eazy-E. And that's what I was thinking. I was thinking that they was big on Ruthless Records, and that's why they kind of ran with that Ruthless by Law. And definitely Black Seas dealt with a ruthless lifestyle through the years. Really sad moments. I mean, both of his group members were literally murdered. He's the only remaining member. I mean, same thing with CMG from Conscious Daughter. She's the only remaining member. I mean, so many people in hip hop have passed away and died. If it's not overdoses or murder or just dying from health issues and whatnot. I mean, we're losing a lot of people in hip-hop, man. A lot of people in hip-hop, man. It's crazy. Once again, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Live from Vietnam. I'm the one and only Paul Masson. Check me out tomorrow. And don't forget, I got some new Bare Knuckle interviews coming on the way. We got one Sunday, Christine Vicens, and we got Elvin Brito on Tuesday. He's going to be live from Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, yeah. Peace, and I'm out.